If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right, everybody. This is the How to Hunt Turkey podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. And as most of you guys have probably found out by now, I'm not the guy who is in. I'm not in with the turkey culture. Like, I'm not in with the turkey industry like I am in the whitetail side of things. And so I reached out to a guy that I know who loves turkey hunting, who was on the podcast earlier, Jimmy Smith. And I said, "Hey, dude, I need a guy. And so he said, "You need to talk to Matt Moret." And so here we are, Mr. Matt Moret. Welcome to the How to Hunt Turkey podcast, my friend.
Well, good morning, Dan. There's nothing I want to talk about more right now today than turkeys. And you know, we're getting a little weather break out here, and think it's starting to feel like spring is in the air. So that's a good thing.
That's a fact, man. Okay. So we just got off of the NWTF convention weekend. Before we started recording, you said that you've been to almost every single one since 1987. That's a big run right there of showing up. Talk to me about what happens at that convention, what it is, why people should go to it if they love turkey hunting.
Well, number one, you know, the National Wild Turkey Federation, you know, that was formed 50 years ago, was formed by a bunch of turkey hunters that just loved turkeys and wanted to see turkeys in more places. And there's so many things that happen at that convention. This was the biggest and best ever. Like you said earlier, I've been to a whole bunch of them, and you know, just to get 100,000 people, and I'm just making a stab at how many people came through those doors. You know, last year they had 80,000 come through the doors at Opryland in Nashville, and this year was way more crowded. So I'm making a stab that say we're getting close to those numbers. But those people are living, breathing, eating, sleeping, turkey hunting. Kind of have cabin fever from the wintertime, and you know, a lot of places in the South are starting to hear some turkeys gobble. But, you know, if any turkey call manufacturer, anybody that makes anything turkey related, plus You know, everybody there's a whitetail enthusiast as well. And yeah, it's just a big, big hunting camp that happens in February around Valentine's Day every year in Nashville at Opryland. And it as a hunter, it's just like, it's like going to one of the coolest places in the world. And there's no strangers down there. You can talk to everybody that you see on TV or YouTube or, you know, social media influencers. Mm-hmm. You can talk to anybody. And, you know, there's always, if you go there with an open mind, you can always come back out of there with something. I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I do have to ask a crazy question because I was on the trade show circuit for a long time in the mid 2000s, all the way up until the early 2010s before I kind of shut that down, that part of my life down. And then I went to the ATA shows for quite a while, but there was always a guy there who would blow a crow call or would blow a coyote howl. And there was a guy at always had a booth in turkeys, and he would go at it all day long. Right. And I can just imagine that's amplified with it being the NWTF show. Do you ever get a headache going to those shows?
Well, it's been such a part of my life since, you know, I'm 56 years old and I started competing in turkey calling when I was 7. So almost 50 years. I kind of tone it out, but you know, when you get to some of those loud waterfowl calls or whatever, but at the turkey show, what you just explained, it's on steroids because everybody's making some noise. That's why they're there. I mean, people got blisters on their tongue when they come home from Nashville from running mouth calls and selling mouth calls. But it definitely happens. And, you know, we just had the same time that we have a show here where I live now in Pennsylvania, the Harrisburg show, which is the NRA show, which is 40 acres under roof. And, you know, it's the biggest one in the country. It's 9 days long. So I kind of got primed up for turkey show before I left at that sport show a couple of days. You know, I work here at our state wildlife agency now, and we had a big booth down in Harrisburg. And yes, those noisemakers are there for sure.
Yeah. What kind of people you mentioned who shows up, but what is the benefit that comes from that NWTF show, in your opinion?
So, the National Wild Turkey Federation, when you look at wild turkeys across the country from Maine to Florida all the way to California, when you look at, you know, Target 2000, and that was the goal of the NWTF to make sure there was turkeys in all 50 states or in 49 states.
Right.
And that happened in 2000. We had trap and transfer program and just the conservation of the wild turkey and celebrating that. And, you know, what really happens at that show is conservation at its finest. When you look at the money that's raised that goes into every state and, you know, right now across the country, when, you know, there's some giant concerns on turkey populations in lots of places, including the state of Iowa. All 50 state wild turkey biologists were there for technical meetings throughout the weekend. And that's just part, that's a lot of the parts you don't see what happens at the convention. You know, at the other thing that happens at the convention is the Grand National Turkey Calling Contest. And that's really how the whole convention started, was formed around that turkey calling contest, which is a bunch of turkey hunters that are trying to get better at making turkey sounds. And, you know, that's how that convention started. And obviously the sports show part of it is a huge thing. And there's seminars and just trainings going on throughout the whole weekend. I mean, all centered to wild turkeys and making sure that we can all leave it better than we found it. When you look at it, the big picture, that's what that convention is really about. It's not about signing hats or necessarily selling turkey calls. It's about making sure that turkeys, wild turkeys, and the turkey hunting culture just precedes us when we're too old to do it and passing it along. And it was the greatest thing to see the younger generation there, and they showed up for sure.
Yeah, man, I'll tell you this. This is something that I have a really good feeling about, is the 20-year-olds who, I don't know, everybody wants to go after big bucks, right? But there's a passion I feel for wildlife now, whether it's waterfowl or whitetails or turkeys or, hell, you name it, pollinators. I mean, anything, butterflies. There are a group of people that are in their, I'm going to guess, 20s right now, that are very passionate about whatever it is they do, and they know how to use social media better than we do. And they've been on it their entire life, and they know how to use it as a tool, and they know how to rally other people. That I'm gonna say, just out of guess, guys like us, you know, because I'm 45 and you're 10 years older than me, so like that we never had the ability to do. So I feel like there's a strong passion with the younger generation that's gonna keep it alive, even past us.
I agree 100%. And, you know, for my personal life, I can give you a great example. You know, I made a living for a long time selling things to help people be successful out there and filling tags, whether it was turkey calls, decoys. You know, I worked at Hunter Specialties there close to you for nearly 30 years and, you know, chasing big bucks around the country. But when you look at as a whole today, I came to work for our wildlife agency, the Pennsylvania Game Commission, almost 7 years ago. This April will be 7 years. I didn't realize what conservation was until I got behind those walls, because there's a lot that goes into it. I always wanted to, you know, fill a tag or chase a big deer, whatever. But when you look at it, and hunters being the first line of conservation, in my opinion, there's a lot that goes on. And exactly what you just said, there's a lot of folks that care so deep, even to get down into pollinators and butterflies and things like that. When you care that deep about it, they're definitely going to lead it into a better direction as the world changes every day.
Yeah. 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 And I think that instead of, I don't know, like I grew up when deer hunting was like my property, my deer type of deal. And now I think there's just these groups of people who understand that in order to have next year's big buck or have next year's 4-year-old Tom, you got to do something different. You got to make sure the habitat's right. The rules and regulations are in the right spot to match all of these things. And I really feel like you're starting to see a little bit more of that now than, you know, even 5 years ago.
Yeah. It's crazy when, you know, when you look at the soup that you have to make, if you will, or the ingredients that have to go into it, all of that matters so much. And, you know, when you use words like conservation or habitat, you know, a lot of folks really don't understand habitat to its fullest. And I'll tell you right now, I was one of them, and I still don't. I learn every day. I work with a whole bunch of habitat managers and foresters and folks that can walk through the woods and look on the ground and show anybody stuff that's there that deer have to have to make it through hard winters. And, you know, getting the population where the area that they live in, you know, when that population gets too high, bad things happen and right. It affects all wildlife. You know, the crazy thing is the first place that I ever looked at coming to this agency, we went into a place where golden wing warbler, you know, one of the bird conservancies, they helped fund a project, a clear cut, and went in there to make better habitat for these Tweety birds, which in turn made better habitat for whitetails. And it was a small place, but the amount of game that was in there and turkeys that inhabited it was amazing. And if we all can just take a little bit and study and learn a little bit more habitat, we definitely can leave it better. You know, and whitetails, I love them like anybody else. I chase big bucks all over the country. I lived out there in Iowa for 7 years and spent a lot of time in Iowa and North Missouri through my whole life. And, you know, when you think about big bucks, it's awesome. But there's also that other side of things with harvesting the right amount of does and keeping that herd in balance. And that's one of the problems we face here in Pennsylvania is, you know, trying to make sure that we can keep that herd in balance in areas so there is plenty of habitat out there for those animals to survive for years to come. You have to have long-term glasses on sometimes.
Yeah. And that's something that I definitely want to get into today is the conservation piece, but I want to get a little bit of the timeline here.
Okay.
As far as for Mr. Matt Moret. But before we do that, I do have to send a quick shout out to one of our partners over at Montana Decoy. If you're looking for a lightweight, realistic, packable decoy that you can stuff in a pack, pop up at a moment's notice, throw it in the ground, and start calling, go check out Montana Decoy. They have a badass lineup of turkey decoys, antelope, mule deer, whitetails, elk. They even got cows to get closer to the big game out west, that kind of stuff. Go check out MontanaDecoy.com. All right. Where does Matt Moret's passion
for wild turkey, or I should say not where, but it's a where and a when. Where and when did your passion for turkey hunting start?
Started pretty young. You know, turkey hunting, we had our first spring season here in Pennsylvania in 1968. That was 2 years before I was born. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened that my dad was addicted to turkey hunting. So, you know, as soon as I could walk and talk, like I was around.
You didn't have a chance.
And you know, back then nobody really knew anything. And if they did know anything, they didn't share that information. Mm-hmm. So long story short, you know, I just used to imitate him with my mouth. And I started competing in turkey calling contests at 6 years old.
Yeah.
And that's how it started for me. And, you know, we have that big show that I was talking about here in Harrisburg. And I started going to that show and my heroes were at that show. Guys, and a lot of folks won't know these names, but Ben Rogers Lee and Harold and David, you know, Harold Knight and David Hale and Preston Pittman and Eddie, I could go on and on. Those guys were my heroes. And that's how it started for me. And I started competing in turkey calling contests. Well, that led about, you know, 10 years around here locally in Pennsylvania, which there was a contest every weekend. And the reason being is we didn't have social media. We didn't have VHS tapes. The information that people would get were at these sports shows, which every town and every county had these sports shows and a turkey calling contest. Well, when I was 15 and 16, we started traveling out of the state to some of the more major contests. And I got lucky at 16 years old to win the world championship for the first time in the adult division. And that led to the start of a career where a company that's from Cedar Rapids, Iowa at the time, Hunter Specialties, which HS Strutt was just forming with that company. And they hired me as a junior in high school, and I worked for them for 25 years after that, helping build that HS Strutt line and the Primetime line and the Centaway, you know, all the whitetail stuff. And I was right there in the inception of a lot of the growth of Hunter Specialties. And, you know, eventually, like all good things come to an end, that company sold to a more of a conglomerate. And at that time, I still was competing at HS, but at that time, you know, I stopped competing in calling contests, and I was fortunate to win many of the major contests across the country and just keep my name and my love for the sport and developing products. A company out of Ohio, Zink and Avian X Decoys, were starting a turkey side of things. Fred Zink was a big waterfowler, and they hired me to help with the turkey line, and was there about 7 or 8 years. Same thing happened, and they sold to a larger company that was buying multiple brands, and it was my time to look for something else and landed here at the Pennsylvania Game Commission. And for me, it's a way that, you know, I made a living and a good living throughout the years in the turkey and whitetail space. And I was able to give back and learn and be able to leave it even better than I found it with what I'm doing over here at the Game Commission. And we're running the marketing bureau here that you know, just spreads the good word about what we do here in Pennsylvania, trying to encourage people to, in a day where hunting, a lot of states are seeing, you know, decline in hunters. We're trying to keep it at the forefront and keep those people engaged in conservation and hunting and outdoor, you know, activities revolved around wildlife.
Yeah. Okay. So how old were you when you won your first turkey calling competition?
So I started at six and won my first contest when I was 8 years old.
For a kids division or for the adults division?
That was in the junior division. That was in the kids division. And to be honest with you, I was the only competitor in that division at that contest I won. But I won't trade. I still have that trophy at home. I'm not trading that one for the world.
Hey, man, you showed up, right? That's all that matters. Why did you get into turkey calling?
You know, I played sports as a kid. I played baseball and football and wrestled. And I you know, I was half decent at baseball, but I sucked at the other things that I tried to do. But yeah, I loved wearing camouflage. I loved going there and all of my heroes and mentors and people that I looked up to, they would reach out with open arms. And it was like part of a family. You know, I met my best friends through turkey calling, and that's just what it was. I couldn't wait to, you know, till this time of year to happen, because that's when most of the contests would happen, preluding to turkey season. And and I got good at it. And I don't mean that in an arrogant way. I got to where I spent a lot of, my dad, you know, would take me out and we'd sit and listen to turkeys for hours and hours. And I started raising some turkeys at home just to get better at calling. And you know, there's so many people that say that, you know, you don't have to be a champion caller to call a turkey up. And they're absolutely right. But I can tell you, the more you sound like a hen, the more turkeys you put at the end of your feed. I mean, you can't argue that point with anybody.
Yeah. I believe, I hope I get his name right. Last week we had Scott Ellis on.
Oh, sure.
Did you ever have to go against him? Because he was on the previous episode of this podcast.
I probably have at one point later in my career, but he really came on stronger after I was completely done. I was smart enough to realize that it's time to get out of it because, you know, as it became a job for me and you know, you got to practice. And I just didn't put the time and effort into it. I kind of went out when I wasn't on top, but I was pretty competitive at that time. But when I saw this next wave coming on, you know, I knew it was, you know, it's time to get out. Even last week, I watched a lot of the contests there in Nashville, and it makes me want to do it again when I go there. But I know that I don't have the dedication, time, or probably the skill to compete with some of these guys today.
Yeah. In your opinion, what makes a good or maybe even a great competitive turkey caller?
Well, you have to be a student of the language. You have to spend time with turkeys. And nowadays it's a little bit easier because you can go on YouTube and watch 2,000 hens yelp. You know, back when I was coming up, you had to get out in the woods and listen to them.
Yeah.
And to me, you got to be a student. You got to be willing to take a risk. You got to also be willing to change things up. And you see that happen. You know, the winner that happened of the big one, the Grand Nationals this year, the senior division winner, Hunter Wallace, he's from Pennsylvania, and he spends every waking moment out there in the woods. He's with those turkeys, and he's not scared to try something a little bit different and develop his own sound. Every hen's got a different voice.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what makes a good caller. I mean, you got to go up there and make those judges feel like they're in the woods is the bottom line. And you know, when you look at the youngsters coming up through, I mean, the talent out there is pretty rich. And you know, they just keep getting better and better and better, working on their skill set. And that's what it takes. It takes an open mind. You try to be a trendsetter and don't copy the guy down the street because, you know, even if you try to copy the winners, you're never going to be that person that leads the pack. And I think that's the most important thing.
Right. Yeah. I never got the opportunity to be a turkey caller because I was so bad at it that the people around me just told me to shut up. And because I was just annoying them, and I kind of gave up and just was like, okay, well, I'm going to kill them with slate in box calls. That's it. So that's how I kind of grew up learning.
But
if
you think about a friction call, the tone is built into that call.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you can sound like a hen. You live in a pretty good area to become a turkey hunter too. When you look at Iowa, I first started coming out there when they didn't let non-residents hunt. You know, and Iowa's came a long way, and the opportunities that you have in that state and surrounding states for turkey hunting are pretty impressive, are pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. In all of the parts that don't have agriculture, we got some okay populations now. I will say this, 7 years ago, 10 years ago, it was magical.
Oh, it's unreal. It was unbelievable. And if you look at that, you can blame it on lots of things. There's tons of reasons. And like, I would love to point my finger at it and say it's this, but you know, the biggest thing is habitat. And when you look at it, you know, turkeys first got put in southern Iowa and they exploded across the state. Yeah. When you can go out and hear 20 plus gobblers a morning, that's pretty magical. Yep. I don't care where you're at.
Yep. That's a fact. Well, that kind of leads us into the, you know, so it sounds to me like you had a career of working with products, you know, whether it was decoys or hunt, different type of hunting. Why don't I just ask you this? Like, talk to me about your time working at HS Strut and Hunter Specialties and what you did there.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously we started in just promoting the turkey line from I'd be on an airplane this time of year from Maine to California, promoting turkey hunting, selling them products. I got to watch a lot of states where it was very infant when you could sell anything to anybody because they didn't know anything about turkey hunting. So we got to watch that sport grow throughout the country. Wisconsin's a great example. I remember the very first time I went to Wisconsin, it was in February, and I didn't live in Iowa at that time. And it's pretty cold here in Pennsylvania, but I landed in Madison, Wisconsin in February. I didn't know that it could get that cold. And we went up to a little town called Sauk City, just north of Madison. I think it's north of Madison.
Yeah.
And it was an Ace Hardware. And there was myself and a guy named Eddie Salter and Will Primos. And we, from, you know, we were there selling our products and talking to a group of hunters that never got to turkey hunt because they didn't, you know, turkeys were brand new up there. And, you know, that's what I did early in my career. We did a lot of product development. We started in the late 80s doing instructional DVD or instructional VHSs at that time on how to call, which then led into hunting videos and our television show that was on the Outdoor Channel for a couple decades, HS mm-hmm. Outdoors, where we hunted, you know, whitetails, turkeys and elk across the country and predators and waterfowl. But I stuck to deer and turkeys because that's really who I was. And, you know, developed that product, those product lines to sell to, you know, when HS was at its biggest, there wasn't a store in the country that didn't handle Hunter Specialties products, which were, you know, right there from Cedar Rapids. And the same thing with Zinc and Avian X. When I went to work with the Zinc crew, they had been in the waterfowl business and just started getting into turkeys and, you know, developed their call line and their decoy line. And same thing, you know, television, we were on TV and social media was just started. I didn't even have a Facebook account when I went in 2012, you know, and all these young guys were like, hey, man, you got to get Facebook. And, you know, Twitter was starting. I had some friends that in Nashville that were, you know, country artists, and Twitter was real big then. And then, you know, you thought you were the crap when you were, you know, answering these people and doing lives on those social media feeds. And to see where that, you know, today television is still there, but, it, you know, social media is where it's at. But, you know, I kind of did all that stuff with those companies and basically just developing and promoting turkey hunting and products, you know, from coast to coast.
Yeah. Awesome, man. And that sounds, and you were in your 20s, I'm guessing, around that time?
I worked in that business from 20. I started when I was, you know, just out of college in 1920 when I went full time. And then, and I didn't finish college. I went for 2 years and then realized that I could make a living doing what I love till, you know, I came over here when I was 49 years old. So I had, all, you know, 3 decades of incredible times, and my 20s are different than the 20s that are out there right now.
Yeah. Yeah, man. It sounds like a great time to be in an infant industry.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Because I'm guessing right around those times is when, you know, as you were a kid and growing up there, you know, in the late 60s and 70s and into the 80s, you're talking about a turkey populations that probably didn't exist in certain places at that time.
Absolutely. Even here in my home state, you know, I remember, you know, I couldn't hunt till I was 12, which was 1982. And I remember hunting the same turkey all season with my dad because it was the only turkey that was gobbling in our, you know, that we found that we could hunt in our places that we had. And, you know, either shot that turkey or you messed him up so bad that he went silent and you didn't hear one the rest of the season. To today, you know, we're, even though the populations are, you know, probably not as good as they were 10 years ago, like you said, in a lot of places, people have gotten way more information today. They're better turkey hunters. You know, everybody can call. You got great looking decoys, like you talked about Montana. You can put one of them out. You know, blinds, better ammunition. Everything's better for the turkey hunter. We've gotten better at getting turkeys into gun range or bow range. Yep. And, you know, we're living in the best times. And like you said, there were many days you spent and didn't hear a turkey gobble or didn't see a turkey, or, you know, you hunted a ghost for a long time. We're living in the best days of conservation that I've seen in my 50 plus years of life, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I'll tell you this. I was spoiled when I started turkey hunting in the late 90s and early 2000s. And I can just remember stepping out into the woods and I didn't even have to call. Some random owl would throw a hoot out and it was just a chain of gobbles all the way down the river bottom until you could just barely hear them. It was a chain reaction. And so I can just remember those were the best days. I think those were the best days for several reasons. And now I have a different version of what the best days are because now I get to take my kids with me and
absolutely, you know,
that kind of stuff. But
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
With you in the last 7 years, and maybe even your experience being a turkey hunter throughout the country or wherever it was that you hunted, and now you're stepping into this conservation role for the last 7 years, talk to me a little bit about. And if you want to use Pennsylvania as the specific example, feel free to. Talk to me a little bit about the ebbs and flows of the turkey population in North America or Pennsylvania, and what you feel is causing the dips and then the rises as far as what you know.
Yeah, this is what, you know, from my personal opinion, it probably differs from a lot of our biologists and things like that. But, you know, when you look at it as a whole, when you look at the turkey population, I think one of the things that happened in Iowa is a great example of this. You know, when they first established them in southern Iowa, you know, and up the river, the turkey population exploded. Like as anything, when you try to reestablish a species of something, and I don't mean there wasn't any turkeys there, but I mean, when they did the trap and transfers and everything that happened, the population explodes. That's the first thing that happens. When we do that, it's just natural. Yeah. And then it kind of gets to where it is carrying capacity and normal. I think that's one thing when you look at that from the biological side, and I'm not a biologist. This is just what I've learned since I've been here. But I think one of the other things is, you know, we are predators, human beings. We are predators, and we become better predators on turkeys. And there's lots of studies out there that are going on right now. I mean, predation happens. You know, we're a predator as well. And we're probably the biggest predator on wild turkeys, especially gobblers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when the predator prey species have to live out there. And I think when you look at trapping in that time frame in the 80s and 90s, when it was really establishing and fur prices were a lot higher. Everybody was trapping at that time and managing those resources a little different than they're managing them today. I see a spark out there in trapping more for predator management because of turkeys and, you know, what you have out there like pheasants and, you know, ground nesting birds. I think it's important. And we're seeing a little bit of spark in that and coyote hunting and things like that. But I think overall, you know, also habitat, you know, just, you know, I kind of am familiar with the area you live because I lived in Cedar Rapids for a long time. And look at the turkeys that are like right outside or in the city limits.
All right. Yeah.
Marion. I mean, there wasn't turkeys. It's just like that here in Pennsylvania. My office isn't very far from downtown Harrisburg. And when I was at the show last week, people were sending me pictures of gobblers and, you know, right across the street and you're almost in the city. That didn't happen. Turkeys are finding those places where the habitat's suitable for them. And in a lot of those places you can't hunt because it's too close to the houses and things like that. I think there's a lot of things that we're seeing out there. The good thing is there's a whole lot of states that are trying to study it and figure out what's going on and why we're seeing this. And quite honestly, it's probably natural. And you know, we're proposing this year, we've been allowed to buy a second turkey tag here in Pennsylvania for the last, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years. And, you know, this year we had just a milestone. This is going to sound crazy to you, but this is the very first year that Sunday hunting. We had a couple Sundays in the past that got legislated through, but the governor signed the bill to let us control Sunday hunting, and Sunday hunting is going to be open throughout in 2027 throughout all hunting season, which is something that's huge here in Pennsylvania. But you have to think about too, we got over 200,000 roughly turkey hunters in this state. We had 6 more days of turkey season when everybody has off work. We have to be careful with the resource. So it's proposed right now that we're going to go to 1 turkey in 27. We'll see if that happens in April, but we will be allowed to hunt all Sundays. And you're seeing a lot of states work on their bag limits. A lot of the southern states where it's been very liberal You know, Alabama could shoot five, and that's back down to three now. And I think that's where they're at. But a lot of those states, Ohio is a one turkey state now. And,
yeah. And
you know, Missouri's looking at non-residents. And I think you're going to see that happen. You know, Iowa is great because they control it with the draw system for non-residents too.
Yeah.
You know, and same with their whitetails. I mean, when it takes 7 years to get an archery tag in the state of Iowa, it's showing you that the resource comes first in your DNR's mind.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, man, I have no problems with the Iowa DNR, you know, as far as the tag allocations are concerned and things like that. I just hope they don't get influenced by, what are those people called, that sit in the lobby, the lobbyists. There we go. The lobbyists. Hopefully the politicians aren't starting to get influenced, but we have a really good support group who defends the wildlife here in Iowa. So I'm very happy about that. One thing that I was talking to a wildlife biologist on a different podcast several years ago. And they did some pretty unique studies of wild turkey and who their predators were. And it blows my mind all of the things that will try to kill a wild turkey and or eat their eggs when they're nesting on the ground. And so what you find is the amount of any species in the world, anytime there's a large population of infants born at the same time, whether it's fish or birds, it just means that a majority of those babies are not making it out to adults, right? So you got to have in order for a species to continue, you got to have more babies, right? And so it was just crazy going, he starts listing all of the things that eat either the eggs or the turkeys, everything from, you know, owls dive bombing them while they're on the roost to bobcats while they're on the ground, and like any type of even dogs and house cats and anything like that. But the one animal that took me by complete surprise, and he says it's a problem for pheasant eggs and it's a problem for nesting turkeys, is blue jays.
Really?
Are notorious nest raiders.
Yeah, for getting eggs. I never thought about that, but that could happen. I mean,
yeah, that's crazy. I didn't think, but I look at it now. I go, you know, all birds essentially are predators in some aspect, eating bugs and worms and whatever they can find.
Or
right?
Birds eat at your bird feeder.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So,
yep.
It was just kind of interesting to me. How much of your job is relaying scientific research to the public from what you find?
A lot of our job is that, because, you know, and you know, we're really lucky as agencies across this country to have folks that have devoted their life to studying wildlife. And those people are so smart, mm-hmm. that when they write something down, people like me can't read it or understand it. And that's, I mean, my job is we're trying to translate it, mm-hmm. where people can comprehend. And that's why our agency is very lucky to be able to have a marketing department. A lot of agencies don't have that, bottom line is Pennsylvania, our forefathers are smart enough to buy land. And yeah. we have a public state game land system here in this state, which is devoted strictly to wildlife. Like when we do a timber cut, it's not to sell the timber, it's for wildlife. But we have over 1.5 million acres that we own. And the coolest thing is that when, you know, natural gas, we live in that area where natural gas is. So we're able to, you know, take some of those natural resources to pay for wildlife for the future. And we have the agency in such a great place right now for the future that funding for wildlife, you know, is looking very incredible here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
But you know, we deal with those folks all the time, and you know, they're boots on the ground, nose in the dirt, trying to figure these things out. Going back to those predators, you know in the late 60s, early 70s, a lot of the turkey biologists and studies have found that, you know, great horned owls are a major predator on turkeys, especially hens on the nest, because they hunt at night, and we're finding a lot of these, just, you know, they'd probably kill me if I say this, but a lot of the information that's coming out of our hen study, we're seeing a lot of those avian predators, mm-hmm. especially on hens. And, you know, when a gobbler he's most susceptible to predation in that springtime ritual because he's out there screaming his head off trying to, you know, he's trying to attract hens. And if it's us, that's what we're hunting. We're hunting that gobble. Yep. But so is everything else out there. I mean, a lot of them, coyotes and bobcats and things like that can get to them. And here's an interest. When you talk about predator prey, what do you think the biggest predator is here in our state of Pennsylvania on whitetail fawns?
Probably bears.
If you had to guess. Yeah.
Bears.
That's exactly right. And a lot of folks here in Pennsylvania think don't realize how big of a predator a black bear is. But, you know, that time of year, they're out there trying to make a meal. And and like you said, in the springtime, a whole bunch of little babies are happening. And those predators, you know, that's the time where they can flourish.
Yeah, that's amazing. What are some other exciting things that you get to do with your job talking about conservation about Pennsylvania?
So, you know, it's exciting and humbling at the same time because, you know, I came from a place where we were selling fun, like we were making turkey calls and making people better hunters. And the humbling experience here is that everybody doesn't agree with you. And I get it because I didn't agree with and still sometimes like my personal opinions don't match what I have to do for a living, but I have to do it for the betterment of wildlife, a betterment of the future. And sometimes it's hard. I think the coolest thing that I try to do is bring us all together in a world where we're so divided right now in lots of aspects. And you were talking about, you know, the legislators a while ago, the political side of what we do, people don't realize how tough that is. And you know, one of the things that I want to do and leave this better than I found it is just try to work together for a common goal with our, you know, we still have real dang close to 900,000 licensed hunters here in Pennsylvania. Yeah. And we all have to work together, whether we agree or not. The coolest part of my job is going out there face to face and just talking through things and trying to get to a positive place where we can go together. You know, we have right now, even within our ranks, you know, with our hunters, there's a lot of division on what day opening day of deer season should be. And you know, people are passionate about deer hunting, and I respect that passion no matter who you are or what you do, whether you go hunting one day a year or you hunt every day that the season allows you to, we're all on the same team in that common goal. And, you know, we get to do all kinds of cool stuff. My favorite stuff is going out there and just looking at habitat and how our agency is making habitat on the ground that we own and trying to transfer that into people that might have an acre or 10 acres and trying to help them leave that piece of property better when it's not theirs for wildlife. I think that's the coolest thing I get to do is try to translate that and help people out. And, you know, every day has its new challenges and, you know, we're still, you know, our mission at the Game Commission is, you know, to manage wildlife and their habitats while promoting hunting and trapping for, you know, current and future generations. And that long-term vision is something I've never had till I've been here. Cause, you know, 10 years is nothing when you look at wildlife, you know, you look just back to the turn, you know, when we turned into 1900s, none of this stuff was here because it was gone. It was, you know, people were market hunting and there, you know, there weren't deer in certain places.
Yeah.
You know, I hunt in Oklahoma quite a bit and, you know, my buddy that I hunt with out there is, you know, he's not 50 yet, but he remembers when seeing a deer was a big deal. And I remember my grandpa telling stories not too far from where I'm sitting today. And when they saw a deer track, the whole town came to see it because they weren't here. And that was, you know, in the, you know, early 1900s, 1920s.
Yeah.
And 100 years ago, there wasn't any, the wild game wasn't here like it was, and nothing looked the same as it does today.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. One thing that I have to self-reflect, I've been, you know, in the quote unquote hunting industry since somewhere about 2006-ish. And, you know, so now I'm sitting here at like 20-ish years in the space, you know, not all podcasting, but I had some other things that I was doing before that. And the thing that I keep going back to whenever I sit down and really like have a moment to think about my life in the past and this space that I've been in the hunting industry is the people. Talk to me a little bit about some of the people or the importance of the actual people that you've met along the way at this point.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, Banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what's the whole deck with galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds. For whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands for the super athletic stuff, like running gear for cruising up the trail.
Woo!
And the super athlete-ish stuff, like fishing gear for chilling by the creek. Nice cast. Fitness apparel to push for higher reps. You got this. And golf balls priced so you can afford to lose one. Or a few. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athlete-ish, Sierra's got it.
Oh, I met my best friends, people that I, everywhere across the country, you know, whether they're, whatever they do for a living, like, I mean, the thing I've noticed about hunters, they always have open arms for a conversation and they'll always be willing to help you out for the most part. The people make it. And when you look at conservation, conservation is only as good as people. And, you know, I wouldn't trade it for the world. You know, when I just went to the Turkey Federation convention, I mean, that is one giant hunting camp in my book, and my best friends are down there, and just the stories and laughs, and you know, you laugh till your belly hurts and tears coming out your eyes, and you know, when you leave, you're sad to leave for another year, big hugs and say goodbye and wish everybody safe travels. And I can't tell you, when I look at the, you know, from my life, I've had some incredible mentors. You know, I'm glad that I was born into and raised by a hunting family. My dad is 85 and he still gets after it. And, you know, the people are what makes it. That's what makes you want to wake up in the morning, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great answer. Now let's talk a little turkey hunting. Okay. The fun stuff right here. You know, you mentioned that back in the day, in order to be a good caller, there's no social media. So you had to be in the woods. That means that you had, whether it was hunting or maybe you had a gun with you, or maybe you didn't, whatever the case was, talk to me a little bit about some of the biggest aha moments, if any, or maybe it was stuff that was learned, or strategy that was learned over the course of several years when it comes to turkey hunting strategy.
And there's a ton. There's a, you know, I think every hunter goes through a lot of things in their life where you just, there was that time in my 20s where I wanted to shoot everyone. Mm-hmm. And that time in my 40s where I'm like, man, I just want to go out there. You know, you weren't as mad at them, but I think some of the biggest things that I've learned in turkey hunting, number one, when I first was younger, I wanted to hear that turkey gobble till he'd had no breath left. And I would call to him way too much and get him so excited that he'd stay out there about 60, 80 yards and never come into range and walk off and walk out of my life. And then I learned to go, you know what? He's coming to me. He already knows where I'm at. They pinpoint you right away. Maybe I'll shut up and, you know, get him to 20 yards, you know? And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes that we make, because that's why we go hunting. I mean, when the little hairs on your hand stand up and or in the back of your neck, and I mean, they get you fired up. You feel that every time you hear your first gobble of the year. That was one thing. The other thing, and filming, when we got really heavy into filming, I learned that I wasn't patient enough. Yeah. I learned that if we just sat there another 30 minutes, the game was getting played out. I was, you know, a lot of times he'd be gobbling out there and not coming. I'm like, wow, he's hung up, I'm going. And when we were already set up, and back then it was bigger cameras and a lot more work to get out there than today, but patience is key. And, you know, a great example of that is, as we're looking at numbers here in Pennsylvania, our youth season had been a Saturday and our kids showed up. They harvest a bunch of turkeys. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the biggest attributions to that, and this is totally anecdotal, but I firmly believe in that, is that when you're taking a youngster out, the best way to do it is sit in a blind, using decoys and sitting there as long as possible. And I think it shows that if you're patient, success can happen. And so many times you're thinking that turkey's just living his life out there. They're not, I mean, their brain's the size of your thumbnail. They're not smart. And I think if we're more patient, I think that was my biggest aha moment in turkey hunting, is that going back to the old school where my dad would sit there for 4 hours and cluck two or three times and because they didn't know any better. Yeah. And, you know, I always try to perfect my calling. Even today, I try to sound more and more like a hen and not when I'm, for lack of a better term, having a conversation with a turkey, whether it's a hen or a gobbler. I want to sound like what they're talking about out there and yeah. sound like other turkeys that might be out there in the woods. And I there's no doubt that it can make you at least see more turkeys and get in those conversations, not saying too much. And it's always better to create that a little bit mysterious. You want them to come find you. You're going against a little bit of what Mother Nature's out there where hens go to gobblers. You're trying to create a mystery and paint a picture for that gobbler to come pay you a visit.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any favorite techniques or calling sequences, or like, are you the guy who goes out and roosts birds and then you know where they're at the next morning, or are you the guy who steps out of the truck and starts to play the game?
So a lot of that depends on many factors, and I'm that guy that doesn't roost a lot of turkeys you know, been thrown into many places I've never been to in my life and just made it happen because we knew how to play the game with turkeys. Mm-hmm. But I think as a whole, if you're not hunting where there are any turkeys, you're not going to have much luck. It's just like catching 10-pound bass. If you're fishing in a lake that doesn't have any, you're not going to catch any. I think that's one of the biggest mistakes people make, you know, especially in my part of the world. They're hunting where there's no turkeys, and that happens. But, you know, getting out, you got plenty of time right now to get out there and scout around, look around. You know, in Iowa, scouting is, you know, driving up and down section roads with binoculars or, you know, gaining permission on places. And you know, getting to know the lay of the land is crucial, I mean, to your success. Yeah. And going, let's go back. What was the question? I got way off track. I'm sorry.
No, I was just kind of curious if you had like a specific strategy that you kind of imply for every hunt or you employ for every hunt.
I employ a lot of things, but you know, if you went down to basics, I try to get pretty tight on a gobbler and, you know, in the mornings, if I can roost one, I'm not a big rooster. If I'm hunting public ground, I do try to roost turkeys in the evening just to give me a little bit of leg up to get in there on them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people try to get real close. I mean, I try to get tight 100, 150 yards, but I like letting the morning unfold and just sound like one of his girlfriends. Lot of soft talk. Turkeys are always talking. That soft talk can be your best friend. And, you know, if I know I got to get him excited, I get more excited with him and try to get him cranked up. I mean, they're like 18-year-old boys trying to find a date, you know, and that's the way they're thinking. And
right.
if I can tell him stuff and make him promises and
right.
get him excited and then lay off and make him come find me, that's my go-to every time. And, you know, there's a lot of times where you'll call aggressive to him and maybe the whole way down to the end of my boots, I'll call aggressive to them. Every turkey's a little bit different. But, you know, and trust me when I say this, failure happens a lot more than success, no matter what you see on television or YouTube or whatever. And you learn by failure. You don't always learn. Yeah. You learn a lot more by failure than you do success for the biggest part of my hunting career.
Yeah,
same with whitetails. I mean, if we wouldn't fail, the other thing is we wouldn't chase them anymore. It's those ones that get away are the ones that keep you coming back.
That's a fact. That's a fact. I can't believe, like, so I've always been this guy who's kind of identified as a bow hunter. I'm a deer hunter, you know, but I'll pick up the Mossberg to go shoot them in the spring, the turkeys in the spring. But I'm always real nonchalant about it until I have one that gets away, because I'll be honest, I was spoiled by putting myself in the right direction for several years in a row and being that guy who, you know, opening day of season one, I'm out there on a Friday morning. I know where they're going to gobble. I set up, they fly down, they come right to me, bang, let's go eat breakfast, right? Sun's barely over the horizon at this point. And it's like 7 o'clock and I'm already done for the year. And then like 5 years of that. And then the sixth year, I was like, hey, now what's going on? And I started getting pissed about not being able to get, you know, figure it out. And so that's ultimately when I started learning a little bit more about, you know, who they are. It's that failure aspect that kept me coming back. And, I don't know. The other funny story is I got married on April 14th, and instead of going on a honeymoon, me and my wife went turkey hunting, and that first year was brutal. It was wet and raining, and she was just like, what am I doing here? I could be on a beach, but we got to go turkey hunting.
Right.
Are you kidding me? And so, but then she came out of that on year number three, the third year she ever went, and then she went like 5 years in a row, and she shot turkeys every year. So pretty excited about, you know, getting my kids involved, and yeah, my daughter, absolutely. She's already killed a turkey. My son had some tough luck this year, but they're both excited to get out there again this year.
Well, girls make better turkey hunters than us guys. They're the perfect turkey hunting machine. If you think about it, they're better shots than we are. I mean, mm-hmm. and whether we want to admit it or not, you can give a young lady a 22 rifle and a little bit of instruction, and they listen, and it, yep. In 5 minutes, they're hitting quarters. They're good shots. Their patience a lot of times is better than we are, because we get so yep. arrogant about it. Like, we're going to do this and beat our chest, but girls listen and they'll be patient. And the third mm-hmm. thing is what other sport can a girl go out and talk sexy to a male species and then blow its head off at 20 yards? I mean, it's total revenge on the male species, in my opinion, but you know, I've got to take hundreds of people turkey hunting, probably thousands yeah. for their first time. And honestly, when I've taken females that have some interest, it's really fun, because they listen and they get excited, and you know, if they're going to be hooked or not for life, for sure. And
yeah.
you know, like you, I have a daughter, she's 25 now, and she wouldn't miss a turkey season. And I actually made a mistake with her when she was young. I was so, like, she was my boy and my girl. I have one child. Mm. And I was so excited. You know, we have the mentor opportunities now that I didn't have when I was a kid. We had to wait till we're 12. But when she was 8, she showed some interest, and we went and patterned the gun and this and that. And I actually that morning called that youth season, called 3 different gobblers in. She wasn't ready to pull the trigger. And yeah. and I couldn't understand that. And I think sometimes we want our kids to do something so much. We're living through our kids, but she wasn't ready to be a hunter. She wasn't ready to take that animal's life yeah. and wasn't ready until she was 10. And it was a great mistake that I've learned a lesson with. You know, make sure that when you're mentoring or you know, we all want our kids to have success, but I wanted her to learn the right way and be ready. And when that year, when she was 10, we went squirrel hunting and did some other things to prepare her for that. And she's one of my best turkey hunting buddies there is, and doesn't miss it for the world, gets excited. That first, I tell this story all the time. The first turkey she played softball all through college. And when she was 10, she had an opening day of softball that day. We could only hunt till like 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
And got on a turkey late in the morning, and we were pushing the limits of making the softball team, or the softball game that day. But anyway, the turkey finally came in before TSS and all the stuff. She shot it with a 410 at about 8 steps, and it was one of those hunts that was ground shaking. Yeah. And she got so excited, and through all the turkey was laying out there flopping, she turned around, she goes, "Dad, I think I peed my pants." She literally peed her pants on, you know, so excited on her first turkey hunt. So if you pee your pants on your first turkey hunt, you know you're going to be hooked for life.
Oh, man, that's amazing. That's an amazing story.
Except she was sitting in my lap. That was the bad, like, right.
Okay.
That was, yeah. No,
but I'll tell you what, that's something I don't know. Is she married?
She's not married. She's not yet.
Okay, not yet. But that's a story when they hand the microphone to the dad, you tell that story. That's an amazing story.
So, you know, part of my life was doing seminars across the country yeah. forever. And when I'd be close, she'd always want to go to them. And I promise you, every time that I did a seminar and she was there, I told that story. And it helped us sell some more products, too, because people, they realize you're human and relatable. I mean, if you can admit right. that. And she's good with it. She's a nurse now, and she deals with people peeing their pants all the time. So
there you go.
Maybe that's God getting even with her.
There you go. What's one last thing you want to tell us about turkey hunting? Anything?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest thing with turkey hunting, and like I said, it depends where you're at on your career, but filling your tags important. If that's important to you, that's great. But the most important thing is in turkey hunting is when you go to the woods, whether you're going out early in the morning, you know, in Iowa, you could hunt all day, you know, and it doesn't matter when you go out there. Leaving that woods with something is important, and that something is learning. And the more you can learn and never stop learning, the more enjoyable it is out there. I don't care if you're hunting squirrels or rabbits or turkeys or deer or pheasants. Every day out there, let the outdoors be your teacher. And with turkeys, pay attention to language out there and try to mimic what you hear out there. And don't be scared to use it. You don't just have to go out there and yelp five times and cut and cluck and purr. Turkeys are making all kinds of sounds. And the more that you can learn their vocabulary, yeah, whether it's in the woods or on YouTube or whatever, and the more you can perfect your calling, the more fun it's going to be out there. I mean, there's no excuses now with the devices, whether it's a box, slate, mouth call, wing. I don't care what kind of calls you use. They all sound like a turkey. We have the best camouflage in the world that we can blend in out there. Mm-hmm. Turkey's eyesight's better than us. They can see color. You still got to be still at the right times. And you know, no matter what, that turkey's built for survival. I mean, ever since the day they're hatched out of that egg, if they are, do have the opportunity to hatch, something's trying to eat them.
Yeah.
And that mama hen's teaching them to survive out there. But at the same time, she's teaching them their language that they learn. And, you know, learning that language is important. But the biggest thing is learning. And I think even bigger than that is to have fun and enjoy it. We're not out there curing any health problems out there. We're out there to enjoy the outdoors and let it be our teacher, passing it along and making it leaving it better than we found it. I think that's the biggest thing that I can talk about.
I can agree with everything you just said, my friend. Mr. Matt Moret, thank you very much for taking time out of your day to hop on and BS with us just for a little bit. I really appreciate it. I love the history. I love your timeline and what you're doing now, giving back to the natural resource within your job. And so thank you again for taking time to do this.
Absolutely. I thank you, Dan. And to, you know, everybody tuning in, I appreciate y'all. I appreciate you being hunters. And the biggest thing that we can do is leave it better than we found it, like I said before. And if we can go with that mindset and get along, even if we disagree, we're going to do that. And hunting will be here for a long time because we need it out there.
Amen.
How many discounts does USAA Auto Insurance offer? Too many to say here. Multi-vehicle discount, safe driver discount, new vehicle discount, storage discount, legacy.
How many discounts will you stack up? Tap the banner or visit usaa.com/autodiscounts. Restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.